Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. History made today in Egypt. The crowds never gave up. The military stepped in, and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is gone from power. Out. His vice president made the announcement.
President Mohammad Hosni Mubarak has decided to waive the office of the President of the Republic and instructed the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to run the affairs of the country.
The cheers have gone on and on and on in Tahrir Square. Yesterday it was frustration and rage. Today, jubilation. An epic moment. And new questions on what's next. This hour, in a special edition of On Point, the fall of Hosni Mubarak. No calls this hour. We are taping this special On Point as events unfold, but we will go to your reactions and questions at onpointradio.org and from Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Al Jazeera spoke today to Egyptian novelist Attaf Souif about Mubarak stepping down.
I really, really believe that this revolution will win because the clarity of the division between good and evil here is, I mean, it's just so clear and it is so big. And it's not possible that something as good as this will end up being defeated. And I was kind of like, you know, doing something for my own spirits, but in fact it was true. And here we are.
And here we are, something as good as this. We'll hear many voices in this hour from Egypt and beyond. Max Rodenbeck joins us right now from Cairo, Egypt, chief Middle East correspondent for The Economist magazine. Max, thank you very much for joining us. Who is in charge in Egypt right now?
Well, it looks like there's a command council of what they call the supreme authority of the military command. I mean, it's a group of army officers. It's basically the army high command.
And Hosni Mubarak, where is he? What is his status?
Well, he's in retirement. He's flown off to the resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, apparently, and that's where he is. He has a vacation house there. He spent a lot of time there, and that's where he's gone very quietly away from the cameras.
The military has been the immediate instrument of this. Behind them, those enormous crowds in the street. What is the reaction in the streets of Cairo and perhaps around Egypt, Max? Is this what they've been shouting for?
It is very much what they've been shouting for, and people can hardly believe it because it's been 18 amazingly tumultuous days, and there have been several moments in the past few days when it seemed that something might happen, and it's been an emotional roller coaster, and I don't know if you remember even last night, people had there were widespread rumors that of Mubarak's resignation last night. And in the end, he made a speech where he said he was staying on for another 7 months. There was a kind of stunned rage among large numbers of Egyptians about that. So people had almost ceased to believe that this was really possible after so much effort. And so the sudden announcement today, which came without much preparation, was just riveting and you know, just shot like electricity through these huge crowds, which just erupted in just screams and tears. It was amazing.
We've seen them on the television screens dancing and cheering and crying on and on and on in the night, Max. What was it that turned Hosni Mubarak around? Last night, a defiant speech with no indication he would be gone. Today, he is gone. Do we know what happened?
Well, I think there have been maneuverings behind the scenes for quite some time. And the role of the army has been crucial in all of this because this immense popular uprising has really no leadership and was not in a position to take over any kind of charge. They really had one goal, which is to get Hosni Mubarak out, and then a longer-term goal, which is to create a real democracy here. But they had no way of getting from point A to point B. So they were, in a sense, tacitly relying on the army to intervene. And it was unclear until the very last second which side the army was going to be on. The army has been very coy about its role. It says that, you know, it's acting on behalf of the Egyptian people, but it's also tried to act on behalf of the kind of legitimacy of the Egyptian state. And I think what happened was that they gave ex-President Mubarak, a last chance when he said that he would last night that he would hand over some of his powers to his vice president, And the army gave him a last chance to see what the response of the people would be. And today, the response was yet more, even bigger demonstrations and a march on his own palace. So he couldn't, I mean, he had to see the evidence that he was just, he couldn't stay.
And finally, Max, what about the assurance, or is there any assurance, that the military will actually guide the country toward the democracy that the protesters in the streets have been so forcefully calling for?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And I think the assurance, the reason that people feel really pretty confident is that they've seen the strength of their own people power on the street. And there's the assurance that they could do that again and put the military in its place. So it's been a lesson for everyone, all of this. And I think there's a confidence that the military will do the right thing. And also, so the military had actually, in the role that it was playing before, it had said that it would guarantee a transition to democracy in support of President Mubarak's own plan for a sort of slow transition. So the military has already spoken in favor of a transition, of a democratic transition. But we're waiting now to hear, and we'll hear it in the next few hours and days, what the actual plan that the military have in mind is. And there is still something of a mystery about what exactly, how long this will take. But I think the ultimate goal of a more democratic Egypt is Egyptians are generally pretty confident that's going to be the outcome.
Max Rodenbeck with The Economist, chief Middle East correspondent there with us from Cairo on this epic day in Egypt. Max, thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
A BBC reporter asked a demonstrator in the streets of Cairo what he thought might happen next now that Hosni Mubarak has stepped down.
I would like to see a transitional government led by the army, by the higher military council, and maybe perhaps the head of the Supreme Court in Egypt. And that government turns into a civil government. They hold free and fair elections. They dissolve parliament. They held parliamentary elections. And then we can have a leader, a civilian leader that we all respect and admire. And the people would have chosen him, and the country can only move forward from here, I believe.
The hope, the very concrete and material hopes in the streets as celebration engulfs the streets of Cairo tonight. Nick Kristof joins us now from New York, just back from Cairo in Egypt, where he has been reporting for days. Nick Kristof, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You were there in the thick of it in Tahrir Square as all of this unfolded. First of all, Nick, just your reaction to what the whole world is seeing tonight in Egypt.
Well, I mean, I think I tweeted a little bit of Arabic that I remember from the days year ago that in the Kalina Misreen, that today we're all Egyptians, and I really feel that. Boy, I was just so admiring of the courage that these people showed, taking on a police state that really could be remarkably brutal, and maybe the way also that they did it without a lot of Western help. I mean, the truth is that when there were fraudulent parliamentary elections, the West really didn't raise an eyebrow, and yet they were inspired by Tunisians, by Al Jazeera, and people power triumphed over a pretty ruthless police state.
Give us a sense of the scale, how you measure the scale of what is happening right under our noses here today. Is this on the order of 1989 Berlin Wall? You know the history. Where are we?
Well, I mean, one of the fascinating things about these uprisings is that they are contagious, and history has shown that. Whether it was back in 1848 or in 1989, you do see the contagion effect. And obviously, there is a special viral effect when this is the most populous country in the Arab world, in a region where there has been this really pernicious narrative that the Arab world is incapable of growing democracy. And, you know, in a country that it really is the center, the heart and soul of the Arab world. But it also goes beyond that. I mean, I've been wondering what President Hu Jintao of China is thinking when he sees all this unfold. And, you know, my bet is that what he's thinking is, thank God that I blocked Egypt as a search term in the Chinese version of Twitter.
We know that those images of Tahrir Square were not being aired in China. You're celebrating along with Egyptians after your many days among them in this uprising. Nick, you're also writing, already, the game isn't over. And there is a word of caution, maybe more than a word here.
Yeah. you know, it's certainly appropriate to celebrate with Egyptians, but it's also fair to remember that, you know, right now the military is in charge, and the senior generals are in many ways kind of clones of Mubarak. They have a huge economic stake in the system. My bet is that they see themselves as indispensable in the same way that Mubarak saw himself as indispensable. You have a tendency for autocrats to be fooled by their own propaganda, to be out of touch, as we saw. And I guess I worry that the plan for at least some of these generals is to keep the system while throwing Mubarak himself overboard, in a sense to preside over Mubarakism without Mubarak. And I, you know, that obviously will not placate those who have been protesting. I don't think that the U.S. and the West has been very clear about its policies. I think we've been behind the curve all along, and I hope that this is a new start not only for Egypt but also in American and Western policy toward that country, and that we more clearly line up behind those who are pushing for change.
You've seen the determination of those millions of Egyptians in the streets. What does your gut tell you? Are they on a path toward the democracy that they've worked for, or another round of Mubarakism? We've got 30 seconds here, Nick.
I would bet on people power. I remember a young man, a double amputee, who was in a wheelchair, who rolled into Tahrir Square because he wanted to fight for democracy. And, you know, I told him, how can you fight for democracy? And he said, well, I've got my arms, and, you know, God willing, I'll do what I can. And with that kind of spirit, and I saw it all over, I would bet on people power.
Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, thank you very much for being with us, Nick.
My pleasure.
Just back from Cairo, Egypt, where history has been made today. This is a special edition of On Point. We're looking at the fall of Mubarak in Egypt. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is a special edition of On Point. We are looking at the fall of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, the strongman ruler, the U.S. ally of 30 years. Fallen today after 18 days, millions of Egyptians in the streets in Cairo and all around that ancient nation. Across the Arab world tonight, crackling excitement looking on as Egypt celebrates what was only very recently thought absolutely impossible, this deeply entrenched strongman gone. Celebrations, revolution, the military, the instrument that finally made it happen, and now in a very central position of authority, questions about how that will evolve, may evolve toward democracy. Among those who were there in the streets, we have Mohamed El Baradei. Here he is on the BBC today talking about his feelings after the announcement of Mubarak's resignation.
I can't even begin to describe my reaction. I mean, it's a joy, exhilaration, it's a sense of emancipation for 85 million people. It's for the first time Egypt has been liberated and has put its feet on the right track towards a country based on democracy and social justice.
The revolution started online in many ways, and the Facebook world, the Twitterverse, is full of Egyptians celebrating tonight. Reading some of them here, love Egypt, love Egypt, love Egypt. We won. Mubarak is out crying from joy. You showed the world you can. Let the world know the most civilized revolution in the world came out of the Arab world. All those from Twitter. With me in the studio right now, Ashraf Hegazi. He's executive director of the Dubai Initiative at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Egyptian, watching all this happening with the rest of the world today. Ashraf, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And with us, Rami Khoury, internationally syndicated columnist, editor-at-large for Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper. Rami Khoury, thank you. Welcome back to On Point as well.
Glad to be here.
Ashraf, your thoughts, your reactions to what the world has seen today in Egypt.
It's fantastic. The fact that Egyptians are able to do this against such an entrenched, such a powerful regime, I think will send waves through the Arab world and empower people everywhere who are democracy-seeking or freedom-seeking. The one thing to remember, though, is that this is the first step, and now it's we're looking towards the next step. What will the military government look like? To what extent will people have a say in their future? And hopefully the next couple of days will continue to be celebratory.
What's your gut? Are you optimistic? Do you feel some confidence? Is it a wide open question mark?
I am very optimistic. We've seen the people refuse and reject the being pushed back by the regime and even by the military over the past couple of days. So they will not accept anything other than what they've been asking for, which is to have a significant say in their future.
Rami, with your permission, let me get another Egyptian-born voice in here. Mona El-Ghobashi joins us from New York at Barnard College. She's been looking at protest in Egypt for many years. Mona, welcome back to On Point. Congratulations for Egypt today. Your reaction to what we've all seen there?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Like Baradai and all other Egyptian citizens and everybody watching this, I can barely find the words to describe my feelings. I think ecstatic probably gets closest to it. This is unbelievable because Egypt's rulers have historically selected themselves. The Egyptian population has tried but never succeeded in actually having a say in who governs them. And what we saw over the past 18 days was a very significant shift towards having Egypt's people finally have a say in who gets to rule them.
Give us your brightest hope, your brightest hope. We know nothing is secure in this life, in this world, but your brightest hope for what this might mean.
My brightest hope and what I dearly, dearly pray would happen is that the military acts as a professional institution and oversees the transfer of power to a transitional civilian government, perhaps headed by a respected judge and a military officer. And that transitional government, which would exist for 1 year, would preside over the organization of three elections: elections for the presidency, elections to a clean parliament, and finally elections to a constituent assembly that would write a new democratic constitution.
That's a tall order, but it's exactly what's being very explicitly asked for in many quarters in Egypt today as Hosni Mubarak goes. Here's tape of an Egyptian man in Cairo today talking to the BBC about what that departure means to him and his family, his children.
We're 30 years old. We never experienced something called an ex-president. It's something we have never experienced. We're so high on that feeling right now. We're not thinking even of the future, but we're very sure the future is going to be better. Egypt is going to be a better place. My wife is pregnant, and I'm really proud that my kid is going to be born in a new Egypt.
I feel the tingles up my spine. I say, children, it's a child to be. But Rami Koury, you see the passion on those streets tonight, the sense of, at least for the moment, a kind of triumph of breaking open new possibilities of a future for this country, Egypt, and maybe, as you have told us, maybe the entire Arab world.
Well, absolutely the entire Arab world. I think it's important to recognize two things. First of all, this didn't come out of a vacuum. People in the Arab world for about two generations have been demanding, pushing, activating, working, mobilizing for this. The Palestinian intifadas, the Lebanese throwing out the Syrians, the many Egyptian movements, Kifaya, and the Muslim Brothers, the people in Sudan who overthrew Numeiri. You've had movements all over the Arab world for about 30, 40 years, people trying to do this, but they could never do it. They could never break the security state. That's why this is so significant. And it's not just changing Mubarak. It's breaking the modern Arab security state. Hail Tunisia. Hail Egypt. They have done something historically important. What they do next, we hope, will spread throughout the Arab world. And this is not just changing people. This is creating real sovereignty, real democracy, real civilian oversight of the military, real negotiated constitutionalism. I mean, these are unbelievable.
How do you know all that? As we sit here right now, it's the military that's in charge. What gives you confidence that we'll go to that lovely list that you've just outlined?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, and I think in every Egyptian's and every Arab's mind, because if you walk around the Arab world, as I and Ashraf and others have done for the last 30, 40 years, you see this. This is the spirit of the Nile. This is the heart of Arabism. This is the soul of the Middle East, of Christian and Muslim and even a few Jewish Arabs still around. This is so chromosomally inbred in people, the sense of justice, fair play, dignity. They've just never been allowed to do it. They've never been allowed to express it, to manifest it, to configure it into a governance system. It's going to be very, very heartening and very positive. And that kid who's going to be born in Egypt, there's going to be tens of millions like that all over the region.
Ashraf, that child waiting to be born with the proud father we heard there saying he's excited for the future his child faces now. But you heard Nick Kristof and others, Egyptians themselves, Hosni Mubarak is gone. But how? What else needs to be swept away to ensure that Egypt doesn't go from Mubarak to Mubarakism in different clothing?
Exactly. No one wants to go from a police state to a military state. So the entire regime needs to change. The political structure needs to change. Right now, if Vice President Soleiman continues to be in charge, he will continue to do what Mubarak has done. He still runs the security apparatus, and people can't have that anymore. So having a complete transformation of the security apparatus, of the role of the police force in society, and removing military oversight of politics. So having a civilian-run government and a change that allows people to decide their future, not have it decided for them by powerful individuals.
And then there's the issue of the economy. So much power there concentrated during the Mubarak years, not least in the hands of generals. Here's Vice President Joe Biden saying today that Mubarak stepping down is a global game changer.
This is a pivotal moment in history. It's a pivotal moment in not only Mideast history, but in history, I would argue.
Joe Biden making a very large claim for what we've seen today in Egypt. Ashraf Hegazi, Rami Kouri, Mona El-Gojbashi, please stand by. Joining us right now from Washington is Anthony Cordesman. He's in National Security Strategy, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony Cordesman, thank you very much for being with us. What do you see in the developments in Egypt today?
A great deal of uncertainty, and I think that people are again rushing to draw conclusions about the kind of change that's practical. A lot of it based on what they'd like to have by way of political systems rather than how long it's going to take to make real changes in dealing with the grievances people have raised, how long it's going to take to really create a credible new pattern of governance. And for that matter, the level of change you can actually accomplish. It's very easy to talk about dramatic change at this point in time, but whatever happens is going to play out over a period of years and very uncertainly.
Do you believe that what's happened today and in the last 18 days in Egypt is in the interest, define those as you will, of not only perhaps the Egyptian people, but the United States?
I think it is very hard to tell. The odds are that it may be, but the demographics here are, we're talking about a very poor country of some 80 million people. It's extremely young. It has not provided the kind of increase in living standards that is really needed to meet their expectations. There's going to be a real problem in modernizing virtually all of the economy. A lot of the people in the square are reacting to food spikes, job problems, problems in education, and they're all very real. But the people in the square are not the people on the poverty level, and that's a very significant portion in Egypt. Now, can a new government come in and make the kinds of reforms that are really needed? Can it break people out of the trap of the poverty sector? Can it meet the expectations in spite of the population increases? And if so, who is it? Because the one thing that everyone has in common, really, if Mubarak and the elite go, is they've never really made a government work before. And more than that, they've never had to do anything like the level of change that's required to meet people's expectations.
Do you believe that the Egyptian military, which is now effectively in charge in Egypt, will willingly guide the country forward to a real democracy, Anthony Cordesman?
I think that a lot of that is, again, speculation. But if you see too many of the people around Mubarak stay, the answer may be no. Not simply because of the military, but because there are many civilians within the power structure who also are going to resist real change. If you have a shift in the military to career military who care about the nation, and if you see enough change in the political structure so you do not have the carryover from the same ministers that clustered around Mubarak, the same people in parliament that were part of the Mubarak regime, then that's possible. But historically, this is something where you have to be very patient, where it's going to take a lot of help and encouragement from the outside. And celebrating the fall of an authoritarian is fine for about 48 hours. And then you'd better start coming to grips with reality.
We have a lot of Facebook comments and online. Here's one from Mohammed who says, this is a historic opportunity for the U.S. to win the hearts and minds no money or weapon could. If we, the U.S., stand for what is right and noble, we will befriend an entire populace, not just a government. What do you say to that, Anthony Cordesman?
Well, again, this is the 48 hours worth of rhetoric, because what does it really mean? Are we in favor of democracy and representative government? Yes. Do we also want a stable economy? Yes, we'd like that too. Do we want Egypt to develop? Of course. So in all of those areas, you can agree on the goals. And then the question becomes, exactly what is it that the United States can do? And aside from working with the military to ensure that they do move forward to democracy, in terms of economic change, change in the structures of governance, all of the things that are really going to matter to the Egyptian people over time, we can provide influence and advice. But the core to progress is going to be Egyptian, and the United States isn't going to have any more magic wands after Mubarak leaves than it had when Mubarak stayed.
Finally, Anthony Cordesman, there's concern in some quarters, many quarters, about no real change as a possibility. You lay out that out as a possibility here, but there's also concern in some quarters about the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood in whatever should follow them, sort of taking over an Egyptian democracy. What do you think are the odds of that? What will be the signs of whether or not that is happening?
Well, one problem we have is, to the extent there are any public opinion polls at all, they indicate that the Muslim Brotherhood is somewhere below 20% of political support. The problem is none of us know what will emerge here. There certainly were people who ran against Mubarak who were promising. There are many very competent Egyptians who may acquire that kind of political profile. But the whole issue of radicalism, I think, depends more than anything else on the next government failing to meet expectations, failing to provide stability, failing to attract outside investment. I think that unless that happens, and I would not say that's the more probable case, the extreme elements in the Muslim Brotherhood are going to be kept very marginalized, and if anything, the gerontocracy that's in charge of the Muslim Brotherhood is probably going to be replaced by a more competent group of reform leaders, which to some extent they pushed down or sat upon. This isn't some kind of unified group of Islamic extremists. It's a very broad-ranging movement, and while there are negatives within it, there are some very competent reformers as well.
Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies with a note of caution and real politics there. Anthony Cordesman, thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure.
A Facebook comment here from Sam, talking of the Egyptian people. They bucked a powerful system en masse against violent opposition day after day with dignity and determination. Their celebration. Mona El-Gabashi in New York, you hear Anthony Cordesman's word of caution against the 48-hour euphoria. Do you feel our people swept up simply in that? What about his rather stern warning there that there's no guarantee of this working out well or to the satisfaction of those whose protests have brought it about?
Look, I don't think that the Egyptian people, as swept up in their euphoria as they legitimately are allowed to be,
yes,
have any illusions about the momentous tasks facing them in the next few weeks, in the next few months, and indeed in the next few years. And I say that because if there's anything that we learned about this extraordinary 18-day uprising, is that the Egyptian population is extraordinarily shrewd politically. They have always been, and they share that with the rest of the Arab world citizenry. These are people who understand very well the power structures under which they live. They are certainly not making a mad grab for rising expectations or miracle solutions. They know very well what they did. They know very well the constraints of the system under which they have toiled for decades. And they're simply demanding that they have a say in how they're ruled. They are not now going to storm representative institutions and demand 100% increase in wages or all sorts of radical demands. What they're simply saying is, you have to take us into account when you make decisions that affect our lives. And so I actually share Anthony Cordesman's realpolitik, and I assure him that the rest of the Egyptian population shares it as well because they live under those very structures. And I don't think that we necessarily ought to paint them as a bunch of idealistic people who don't know the tasks that lie ahead.
They've accomplished something very real in these last days. Mona El-Ghobashi, please stand by in New York. Ashraf Hegazi with me in the studio, and Rami Khoury. More sound from Tahrir Square in Cairo behind us. What a moment. What a day for Egypt. We're looking at the fall of Hosni Mubarak. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a special edition of On Point, marking the remarkable developments today in Egypt. Hosni Mubarak, after 30 years of strongman rule and close alliance with the United States, is out. The massive crowds in the streets celebrating on and on and on into the night. The military, now with a very central role, all eyes on how the democracy that was fought for here may unfold. With me in the studio, Ashraf Hegazi. He grew up in Egypt. He is executive director of the Dubai Initiative at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Rami Khoury is with us here, columnist and editorial at large for Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper, currently a fellow at Tufts University. And Mona El-Ghobashi is with us, professor of political science, Barnard College. She's covered Egypt for a long, long time, Cairo, the city of her birth. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron to today, expressing support for the Egyptian people, saying there is also much left to be determined.
What has happened today should only be the first step. Those who now run Egypt have a duty to reflect the wishes of the Egyptian people. And in particular, there really must be a move to civilian and democratic rule.
And here, Wael Ghanim, the Google executive who helped organize the initial online campaign against Mubarak, then spent a dozen days in prison. He spoke to CNN just after the news of President Mubarak's resignation breaking today. He said the internet was crucial to this revolution.
This revolution started online. This revolution started on Facebook. This revolution started in June 2010, when hundreds of thousands of Egyptians started collaborating content. I always said that if you want to liberate a society, just give them the internet.
Just give them the internet. It took that and more to make it happen. It took the military in part to make it happen. Lots of response here online from onpointradio.org. Aswan says the entire power structure needs to be replaced, not just the titular removal of Mubarak. Dwight writes, I feel remarkably comfortable that the Egyptian army will do the right thing and let democracy with free and fair elections happen. What power wants to be on the wrong side of history? This movement isn't going away. Tim writes, Dear President Bush, this is how a country gains democracy from within. I'll take 300 civilian casualties over 100,000. I guess a reference to Iraq and civilian casualties there. Rami Khoury, you heard Anthony Cordesman, who joined us with several very big notes of caution about what's happening here and a strong warning against the 48-hour euphoria. I mean, some euphoria is surely in order after such a monumental development. How do you respond to Anthony Cordesman?
Sure, but I just want to make one response to the British Prime Minister, which is that he can keep his advice to himself, because to talk about respecting the wishes of free people in the Arab world while Britain has supported autocrats for decades and decades is just the massive...
You don't want to hear it.
It's the height of hypocrisy, and we're fed up with this kind of nonsense. And this is what I think a lot of people in the Arab world, in Tunis and Egypt, have already said. We don't want to live in this world of double standards and an exploitative, self-serving, hypocritical, whimsical, opportunistic, militaristic foreign penetration of our region.
That's a list.
That's a list, and there's a lot more to it. We
okay.
didn't have time. But Tony Cordesman, I think, is right to make a note of caution. But the reality is that the Egyptian people have about 6,500 years of running themselves, urban life, power politics, negotiating relationships between rulers and people and their gods. They know how to do this.
I mean, you say that, but we've seen them for generations now not fulfilling that kind
of vision of civic
bliss.
Sure, because they had countries that were created by retreating European colonial powers like the British and the French.
Egypt.
And then they had no chance to...
Not Egypt.
They had no chance to rule themselves. Mm. They were run by either, the Ottomans or the British and French for a while, or the kings or the military. For 52, there's been not a single bright moment, except for maybe a few years in the 1930s that were quickly closed. Mm-hmm. But the Arabs have never had a chance to be sovereign and self-determinant. Mm-hmm. This is the whole point of why this is so important. So I think the experience of the people of Egypt is just really profound. They know how to run a society, and they know how to do things fairly and equitably to each other. This is the chance to do it, and that's why I personally feel so confident that given the chance to do it, and if the Americans and the Israelis and the British and the Europeans and others stay out of it, and even some of the Arab countries, just let them do it by themselves, they will do a fine job.
Egypt's ancient tradition is recognized across the Arab world. I mean, it is seen, it has been a cultural leader. How do you think this will resonate? Are we going to see, we've got Tunisia now, Egypt, will we see other governments, other regimes actually fall, or just or simply a period of ferment? What do you anticipate?
I think you'll see several things. You will see the effect of Tunisia and Egypt ripple throughout the region. It already has started to do so. You will see some other countries experience similar kinds of demonstrations that change the regimes and start a new system. And you will see others, as we've started to see already, where rulers try to preempt this kind of change by changing things from the top. You'll have Arabs who suddenly realize that they're like Gorbachev. They can change the system from the top and try to ride it. Mm-hmm. And some of them will and some of them won't. The legitimacy of Arab rulers differs a lot. The nature of grievances of their people mm-hmm. differ a lot. So we'll see a variety of different responses. But what's clear is that all of the people in the region, with the exception of some of the rich Gulf states, all of them suffer similar grievances of social and economic pressures and autocratic rule. So we will definitely see this rippling throughout the region in different forms.
Ashraf, let's look at the economy for a moment. It has been, at least as I understand it, you tell us, but very much tilted toward the coterie of Hosni Mubarak. Now, it's more than that, but a lot of that. What happens with the Egyptian economy now?
Well, I think you'll see a structural change. I think people have a lot of young people who don't have jobs right now will hopefully see an open system where there'll be entrepreneurship. I'm very excited about that.
Why will that happen? What, I mean, the people who owned the money under Mubarak and the companies and the deals, however they were struck, they'll still have them tomorrow morning. Is there another revolution that will now take place? A kind of, grabbing bank accounts and trials and some kind of redistribution here or not?
It's part of this revolution. This is not just political. It is not just social. It is absolutely economic as well. We've already seen assets frozen for current and former ministers, some of the top business executives who have really milked the country and abused the young population especially, but also the workers in general. And a lot of this wealth will be redistributed not through a socialist system, but simply through opportunities for engagement, opportunities to create new companies, new industries, and potentially opportunities to get new loans. All of that was really controlled by a few people at the top. And now, hopefully, there will be a system where young people have access to capital, to new ideas, to a better legal system that allows them to create and manage new companies.
Mona El-Ghobashi, what's it going to take to open up that Egyptian economy now, to wrench it if necessary, if that's what's on the docket here, out of the hands of those who became some fabulously wealthy under Mubarak?
The crucial mechanisms that it's going to take to develop some sort of a redistributive mechanism is what Egyptians have been demanding for at least the past 15 years, which is presence on the institutions, in the institutions, the elected institutions that make crucial economic policies. Remember, one of the key factors that triggered this uprising was the stolen parliamentary elections in November, December 2010,
yes,
in which the ruling party hogged basically 97% of all the seats. The reason that they did that was because they did not want any contentious opposition voices to enter parliament and to start demanding oversight of the kinds of very momentous economic decisions, privatization, public-private partnerships, etc. They wanted oversight of the management of the national economy. And so the route to getting any kind of redistribution is not some free market ideology or some celebratory thing about now all of a sudden we're going to start seeing jobs cropping up everywhere. The only way we're going to see that kind of real redistribution is if people have a place at the negotiating table, whether that is at the municipal level, the national level. People have to get into these institutions and monitor what kind of economic policies are being written down.
But you talk about a revolution. I mean, that is the very stuff of revolution. People don't give up material wealth like that easily. I'm reading here a report. This is from the Times. State radio reporting that Naguib Sawiris, A wealthy, widely respected businessman has agreed to act as a mediator between the opposition and authorities, I guess that means now the military, in carrying through political reform. Mona Ashraf, do you know this man? Is this the kind of guy who's likely to lead a economic revolution in Egypt, Mona?
Well, this gets to the heart of the matter. The military and the high command, the thing that we have to be very careful watching them go forward, and this is why Egyptians are not simply just celebrating in the streets, mm-hmm. is that the military has core vested interests in this economy. They actually own and control huge chunks of the
yes.
economy. And for them to start to make a burgeoning alliance with someone like Naguib Sawiris, who is a very rich man, he wasn't necessarily part of the core of the crony capitalists, but this budding alliance between the military and the business is something that I'm sure that the Egyptian opposition movement is going to be very vigilant of.
Ashraf, speak to the Muslim Brotherhood question. Anthony Cordesman, you heard him address it. Everybody raises it. The 1979 image of an uprising and revolution in Tehran that ended up in an Islamic state that would not abide democracy. What about the Muslim Brotherhood and that risk in Egypt now?
Well, look, there are three groups that support the Muslim Brotherhood. There is the first group is ideologically aligned, but many of those support the reformists within the Brotherhood, who are young leaders who actually want to see Islam interpreted in a way that meets our modern, our current issues, and is very much aligned with democracy. The second group supports the Brotherhood for social welfare reasons. The Brotherhood has been providing them with the social services that the government has failed to provide. They've built schools, they've built hospitals, mosques, they provide their own subsidies for food. So those people have supported the Brotherhood not at all for ideological reasons, but because they are poor and because no one else has been helping them out. The third group has supported the Brotherhood because they are not Mubarak, because there's no other game in town. And if you see what Mubarak is doing and you want to be on the side of a strong opposition group, the Brotherhood was the only option. Now, as the political system is opened, you'll see new parties that are created, both religious and secular, and there will be an option for that third group to go elsewhere. And you'll hopefully see a government that's more responsive to the needs of the people. And so the second group that just needs the social services will be able to get it from the government rather than the Brotherhood.
What does that mean about the possibility of an Islamic bloc emerging that would dominate even rule Egypt?
Well, it means that the support for the Brotherhood will go down. They will lose the second and third groups. But also that first group really supports the reformists. And what we've seen over the past 10 years is whenever the Brotherhood are able and allowed to participate in elections truly, they have moved to the center. Their leadership has changed and their policies have changed. When they have been excluded from the political system, they move to the extreme, because the people who really hate the Mubarak's and the Mubarak regime and who don't believe and don't trust his promises are then able to rise to the top.
Mona, speak to the issue of Israel. Right next door to Egypt, the Israeli government declining to comment on the announcement by the Vice President Sleiman that Mubarak had stepped down. But here's the Associated Press headline or lead out of Jerusalem. Israel watched Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's resignation with trepidation Friday, concerned that the ouster of its staunchest Arab ally might endanger a peace treaty between the two countries and help boost Islamists already on the rise in the region. What about that fear, that trepidation in Israel, Mona?
Well, this is predictable. This is the least favorable option for the Israeli government, what just happened in Egypt today and over the past 18 days. However, we should also be wary of what the Egyptians are actually going to do. I have a very hard time imagining that the current people in charge in Egypt, that is the military, would undertake any radical actions. So we just simply have to wait and see.
Ashraf? Israel and Egypt now. Do you see a status quo somehow going on? Will there be a popular demand for a fundamental change in that relationship, which has anchored the peace there has been in the Middle East for decades?
I don't think there will be a fundamental change, but I think the Egyptian government will definitely be less friendly towards Israel because it will no longer be just a client state of U.S. foreign policy.
Peace treaty, does it stick with it or walk away?
Yeah, peace treaty will stick, but I think you'll see more pressure on Israel coming from Egypt, and as the rest of the Arab world changes, there will be more pressure on Israel from around the Arab world. And this is that's a ray of of sunshine. This might be...
To whom?
to the peace process.
Well, Israel's already feeling kind of surrounded by rising... You know, we see Hezbollah in Lebanon, and now Hamas in Gaza, and now this in Israel. But you say a ray of sunshine to the peace process because it will shake people up and get them to move, to act?
Yeah, exactly. The pressure on Israel has really been very minimal. It's been coming from Obama, period. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been much pressure from Arab governments. There's been pressure from the street, but that doesn't have much of an impact.
Rami Khoury, Al-Qaeda. I've seen headlines saying that this is a disaster for Osama bin Laden, that the people rise up and they speak. It's not essentially with bombs, certainly not with terrorism. It was with a large peaceful protest all over Egypt. What are the implications of these developments for Al-Qaeda?
Well, they're pretty bad. Al-Qaeda has only attracted a few thousand people, possibly all over the 350 million people in the Arab world. So it has infinitesimally small support, and whoever supports it goes to Afghanistan. But Al-Qaeda and the Israelis will both have great lessons to draw from this. A democratic Arab world is good for Israel, good for the Arabs, good for everybody in the region, bad for Al-Qaeda.
Why is it good for Israel it's going to be less friendly to Israel, Ashraf says?
Well, it'll be less friendly because of Israel's policies. You mentioned Hezbollah and Hamas. Hezbollah and Hamas essentially were born and grew to strength and legitimacy because they challenged the Israelis. They were born in the early 1980s because of Israel's occupation of South Lebanon and the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. So Israel should draw clear lessons from this now more rationally than they have before. If they want good relations the Arab world, they need to deal with the Arabs and the Palestinians according to a certain standard of legality and decency, which means there's going to be massive pressure now on the Arabs and the Israelis, I think, to really negotiate a comprehensive peace. That's why it'll be good for everybody. And Al-Qaeda was born in Egyptian and Jordanian jails and Arab jails. So, you know, getting the police state out of the Arab picture is going to create different conditions so you don't get these extremists who are bred in Arab jails.
And Rami, your word to the United States tonight, as Americans look on here and think about their own foreign policy vis-a-vis the Arab world in light of these enormous developments in Egypt, what about the United States?
First of all, look at the Arabs as human beings who have their own rights. Don't look at them in relation to what happened in Iran in 1979. Don't look at them in terms of what the Israelis and the Israel lobby in Washington wants. Look at the Arabs as people who have rights and as human beings who have certain citizenship rights and human rights. And second of all, apply a consistent policy in the Arab world as you apply it in Kosovo and everywhere else.
Rami Khoury, thank you so much for being with us again today.
My pleasure.
Ashraf Agassi, your word to Egyptians tonight as you look out on what's just happened there, your message to Egyptians?
Have a great time. You've earned it. Celebrate, be happy, and be ready in a couple of days to make sure that your new government does what you want.
Mona El-Kabashi, quickly, same question to you. What do you say to Egypt tonight?
Love and respect to all the Egyptians who made this possible.
Mona El-Kabashi at Barnard College, joining us from New York. Thank you so much, Mona.
Thank you.
Ashraf Agassi with me in the studio. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Listeners, great to have you. Egypt, Godspeed. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.